From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capitol Notes podcast for Friday, August 6th. I'm John Myers from KQED, and a special budget expert in the studio today.
Not so special.
He's laughing when I say that. Kevin Yamamura from the Sacramento Bee, who covers the state budget for the Bee. Anthony York has a sick kid, so his smart aleck self will have to stay home today. And I figure we'll just talk a little bit about the budget, because that's kind of big news this week.
In the news this week.
As much as you can call big news with the budget, which is now more than a month late. I think the biggest thing we could talk about at the beginning here is I don't get any real sense that we're close to a deal, and you're shaking your head no too.
No, I don't get any great sense that we're close to a deal, but there are some minor indications out of the governor's office that they see the Democrats at least coming out together with a joint plan as a positive step for further negotiations. And I've heard rumblings that some people can kind of sort of see an outline, but no, I don't think we're close.
Yeah, but even then, the outline's got to deal with some revenue issues, which we need to talk about. So,
that is the unbridgeable gap right now, which is how do you decide between revenues and cuts?
Which, sadly, is not new.
No.
I mean, how many years have we been talking about this? It's old as time. How many years have we been talking? I mean, we seem to have this fight every year, though it feels like a different one to me. I mean, I'm just, before we get into the numbers, it feels a little bit different this time because everybody's seems to be sticking to their guns more.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, after last year, people suffered some political repercussions in the wake of a very difficult budget where everybody had to agree to these decisions they didn't want to make on taxes
left and
cuts.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, people are more entrenched right now, it seems like, and they're not as willing to go to the same place they went last year.
So this week we got the unified Democratic budget proposal that has been talked about now for, what, more than a month?
Yes.
Was it a month ago they said they were on the same page?
That's right. Well, shockingly, they came down to the governor's office on the eve of the fiscal year
June 30th.
Said, we're on the same page. We have a joint Democratic plan, although you heard, as I did, I'm sure, that they weren't always on the same page in the last several weeks, but...
Well, they had to iron out some relatively important differences. I mean, they had to, you know, the Assembly obviously wanted to deal with a borrowing proposal, $8-9 billion of securitization, they would call it, borrowing cash advance.
That is the buzzword around here.
Yeah, right. We're all trying to come up with a phrase for that one. The Senate had more taxes that would go to other things. They had a great big realignment proposal, which is shifting programs to local government from state government. This is the ultimate in wonky podcast this week. So they did have those things to iron out. So what we got on Tuesday was a detailed proposal, fair to say, right?
Yes.
A detailed counter proposal.
And a balance. Well, it looks like a balanced proposal if you look at the way the numbers sort themselves out on their sheet, which they did not have before. Both Democrats in the Senate and Assembly before admitted they had gaps in their proposals before.
So we've got, it's fair to say, a mixture of cuts, taxes, and everybody's favorite budget balancing shifts, loans, transfers, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. It's got a bit of everything.
The tax swap, though, let's talk about that a little bit because we've all written on that. That's the thing that got the first bit of attention here. I'm going to give you, Mr. Guest, here on the podcast, the ability to describe
the pleasure of describing the tax swap. In simple terms, it increases the income tax and the car tax and decreases the sales tax. And Democrats are making the case that this will, for most taxpayers, reduce their overall tax burden by virtue of the sales tax decrease and deductibility of the other two taxes, the car tax and the income tax.
And so everybody basically gets an income tax increase. Though a smaller increase, and this is the part of that makes it difficult to describe, a smaller increase for the wealthy, which isn't really kind of an increase because it's what they're paying now.
Yes. Essentially, they stay the same.
Yeah.
And then everybody else takes a 1% increase on all the other brackets. Yeah.
And what got missing out of a lot of that, I don't know about you, is the notion that everybody's already paying this 0.25% surcharge from the last budget deal. So when you talk, when we talk about it going up by 1%, it's effectively a 1.25% increase because that 0.25% was scheduled to come down, was to expire. So it, you know, so this is all about the sales pitch of these things. I would say in a way, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because you say it's going up by 1%. Well, yes, except that current law was supposed to bring it down slightly, so it's really a 1.25% increase. And then the car tax, same kind of thing to me. Car tax was raised as part of the 2009 budget deal. Existing law said it was going to go back down to 0.65% of the value of a car. This would have it not only retain the current rate, but go up ahead of the current rate to like 1.65%.
That's right.
Of the value of a car. And what I find fascinating about that, and this is an aside on the car tax for a second, is, I mean, this would be, if the Democrats got that, this would be almost the complete undoing of the infamous or famous Arnold Schwarzenegger recall promise to lower the car tax.
It was
2% with the recall. Well, it had been raised up to 2% through that whole Davis kerfuffle. We don't have to go back into all of that. And Schwarzenegger lowered it down, and it's pretty much been lower ever since the budget deal of 2009. And now they want to bring it up effectively almost where it was when it became such a hot button, which makes me think the governor's not going to buy that. But
No. Well, for us political geeks, I guess it would be a nice or an interesting bookend to his career in
almost
office
almost full
here.
Circle,
yes.
Right?
But no, I mean, you just explained all the various intricacies of, well, you know, there's supposed to be a decrease next year because some of the tax hikes they approved last year are supposed to end next year. And this gets to, you know, just the difficulty of going out and selling this because, you know, finance this week came out with their own analysis. The governor's budget team. And said this is a pure and simple a tax increase. Forget about the talk about itemizing and not itemizing. It's even if you account for people who itemize, it's a tax increase on them. And they may have a point. I mean, if you look at it, if you look at the way the Democrats crunched the numbers, what they did was they do take a little bit of advantage of, or they account, they take some credit for the decrease next year in the taxes that are already supposed to decrease. So I don't know. I mean, even LAO couldn't sort it out yesterday, right? I mean,
yeah, the analysts, they said they're still crunching it.
They're still crunching it. So,
and in their normal good guy role, and one in particular, Michael Cohen, who's the deputy legislative analyst, said, you know, basically said, well, there's some good things and maybe they're not some good things. I mean, like he was totally trying to, like, you know, give everybody their due until they crunch the numbers.
Sure.
And, of course, what's interesting is that they haven't finished crunching the numbers, and yet the Budget Conference Committee approved the plan on a majority line, Democratic line vote. So,
yeah, well,
it's theoretically a plan that still has some number crunching to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, the other thing I think is interesting, too, I mean, is that this plan is not new. Your colleague Dan Walters wrote about it, that Steve Peace, former Democratic state senator, budget director under Gray Davis, he can do his long resume, had been talking about this for years. I'd even heard people like David Roberti, the former president pro tem of the state Senate many, many years ago, had been talking about this even years ago, too. So this is not a new idea, this whole idea of let's get the feds to give people more of their money back. Let's take advantage of the fact that state income taxes are deductible on your federal taxes. So it's not a new idea in that way, I guess.
No, and you heard yesterday the legislative analyst, Michael Cohen, had even suggested that it was an appropriate change. I mean, it was a
benefits.
place for the state that the state should look. It's just you wonder how they're going to be able to sell that. And, you know, you tell taxpayers, yeah, your state taxes are going to go up, but, you know, and your income taxes are going to go up and your car tax is going to go up. But you know what? You can just deduct that on your federal forms. And then, you know, when you go to the stores, you'll pay less, too. So it's hard to see how you necessarily sell something like that. But
it's not conveniently describable.
Exactly.
It doesn't have a tagline or something that you could sell it.
Yeah, because, you know, and another point was that they would increase the taxes for 2010. So already, I guess you would owe more than you've withheld, you know, next April.
Yeah, I was going to say, in which case people would be shelling out no matter what because their withholding would be off.
I mean, I'm sure everybody's very responsible and would take all that sales tax savings from their Christmas shopping and put it in a savings account and then use that to pay off their added income tax burden next year.
Of course. We're also responsible. We've got money lying around, especially you and me both with little kids.
But go ahead.
No. Yeah. But what, the other thing that's interesting here, too, is that the plan has been attacked from the left and the right. You know, the right's attack is the tax increase. We're not going to do it. The left side attack, which comes from a number of people, but one really good write-up by Gene Ross, who's heads up the California Budget Project, which advocates for low and middle income folks and tax policies for them, effectively says that what you're doing is you're creating a larger tax burden on the poor, on the working poor. They don't itemize their federal taxes, for one thing. And for another thing, this gets to that whole thing of flattening out the tax structure. And Gene and others have criticized this whole idea where people say volatility is a bad thing, you know, because the volatility actually brings in a lot of money a lot of times, with the wealthy paying as mm-hmm. much as they do. And so that argument is, you know, yes, you're cutting sales taxes, but when you do the final math, it's not going to be great for middle class, working class people. And yeah. So with that sense, I mean, that really makes it politically tough. Wouldn't you agree?
I mean, every no matter whose analysis you look at, whether it was the Democrats or finances, it seemed like the ones who benefited the least were in the middle. And that's a tough thing to sell.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you sell it, actually. I mean, it's...
Well, you think about all the political efforts, state and nationally. Think about every time we talk about the middle class. We always want to help the middle class. Sure. A lot of people would debate whether this is a help to the middle class. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think Democrats are saying, look, here's a way that would inflict the least amount of pain. We need more revenues. We've cut services as much as we can. And... this is a creative solution in a building that doesn't lack for creativity, as we've seen in the last few years.
Yeah, for better or for worse.
And they think this is somehow a way to sell it, that, you know, in the end, that everybody's either going to be paying about the same amount of taxes or less, and that yet take advantage of that federal deductibility to bring in more money for the budget. I think what they were looking for also was a game changer here, right? I mean, talks, as we said at the outset of this podcast, you know, talks had seemed to, you know, both sides had seemed to be pretty entrenched. Each side has their own positions, and they're not really seeming to budge from them all that much. And so I think Democrats here were looking to shake it up a little bit. And, you know, well, it remains to be seen whether they will.
A couple of other things out of the proposal, since we focused on the taxes, but I want to talk a little bit about the cuts too. More social services cuts, and the most difficult part of this, I would argue, politically, and because it's such a big part of the budget pie, is public education, is K-12 schools and community colleges. Under Proposition 98, the Democrats are actually calling for a formal suspension of the Prop 98 guarantee. They would still give the schools more money than the governor was going to give them in his May budget proposal, but they would not give the schools the full amount that the assembly had originally in their budget plan talked about giving them. Am I getting the numbers right effectively here?
It's although if you, 54 it, it, billion, you're right, it's not. I don't think it's the full 54, but it's also not the 52. There's this mechanism in there that they talked about a little bit last night in conference. It would involve
that was
joint
Wednesday
powers.
Night podcast, folks,
I'm sorry.
This on Friday. That's all right.
And nights get mixed up.
I got to give Kevin the whole calendar thing here. Yes, but Wednesday night at conference committee.
So they talked about this joint powers authority setup that would pay back some of the monies owed to schools for state mandates in the past. That would essentially pay them about $1.4 billion or so, on top of about $52 billion. So they'd get.
But that doesn't count toward future funding there, though, does it? In which case, that's why you
suspend
Prop 98,
right? You're right.
And that's the whole complicated thing here, because suspending Prop 98 is this real political tough sell. It's only been suspended technically once ever since being passed in 1988 by the voters, and that was when Arnold Schwarzenegger came into office. There was a mild suspension. I don't know what you call it during the Loma Prieta quake. Uh-huh. You and I hear the same data all the time. So Kevin's nodding his head over here. We've all heard these little milestones in California history. But there's a reason it doesn't get suspended. It's because, again, there's a political ramification to it. It becomes very difficult then to go out and say, I'm protecting school funding when I suspended the guarantee about school funding. And that's why, I mean, you tell me from all the people you talk to, that's why it seems like we get all of these budget deals every year that have all of these things that do everything but suspend 98. Well, we have some statutory way we pay you X, Y, and Z, which allows the school coalition to challenge it in court and get the money back. In other words, there's always a, frankly,
it has
a
sort of,
there's always a political deal cut rather than suspending.
It has some, it's become, you're right, it's sort of a almost mythical proportions. You don't want to suspend 98. I think there's been some thought that schools, I mean, I have to think they've run this obviously past school groups and the
education coalition and the like. Yeah.
There's some thought that they would be okay with it because it ensures that this $3 billion gets paid back to them down the road. And the reason they have to suspend in part is because they're adding all of these new revenues in the Democrats' plan. So the guarantee shot up by virtue of adding these revenues.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit because again, and if you're listening to this podcast, you probably have a little sense of this, but every time you increase tax revenue – the way Prop 98 works is you end up increasing the share that goes to schools.
Has to go to schools. And so by adding the tax on oil production, by adding the corporate tax break delays,
which we haven't talked about, right? The cancellation of these tax deals for businesses.
By adding the tax swap, they're adding new revenues here. And some of that has to go towards schools. So
unless you suspend 98.
You suspend 98.
Yeah.
So the guarantee had actually shot up to like $55 billion, I guess, something in that range. And the only way they were going to be able to use those new taxes to solve the deficit was to suspend 98. Otherwise, a large share of those new revenues weren't going to go toward bridging the actual deficit.
Yeah. So that could be, who knows how tough that sell has been, but that could be a tough sell with some people in addition to the taxes. And then bottom line, I mean, this is a new place from which to negotiate. But again, you talked at the beginning of this, you said that there are people who have told you, I can see a path forward out of this document. And yet that path forward has got to deal with these big boulders like school funding, tax increases, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, those are not small things to overcome.
No, no. If it's a path, it's a path carved out by ants underneath these boulders. I don't know.
It's not a well-marked path.
No, it's... I don't know. It depends. I mean, I think ultimately, there are going to be some new gimmicks that are going to come into play just because those are politically the easiest thing for everybody to do. And as we said before, there's no lack of creativity in that building. So,
what do you make of where the various factions stand now? Let's in most recent years in budget fights, we've had largely three camps. The Democratic majority in the legislature, the Republican minority, and the governor. And we've often talked about the fact that the Republican governor and the Republican legislators weren't necessarily on the same page. This year, we've got Republican legislators lining up behind the governor and his May proposal, so much so that on Tuesday, when the Democrats rolled out theirs, the leaders of the Republicans in the legislature, Dennis Hollingsworth and Martin Garrick, both kept referring to our budget. Well, our budget does X and our budget does Y. Translation, the governor's budget does X and the governor's budget does Y. The Republicans in the legislature have not put forward a budget plan. They are lining up behind the governor, basically.
Yeah,
there are
basically
a few things that they would quibble with, they say, but they say 99% of what the governor's proposed, they're okay with. The reality is what the governor's proposed is not going to go anywhere. Most people don't even believe the governor could sign things like eliminating CalWORKs, things like that. And so that's a very interesting dynamic. I mean, to say that they have a, you know, they have a budget proposal and they've tried to be very critical of, you know, look how long it took the Democrats to come up with one.
Yeah.
You know, and yet the proposal they're lining up behind has no, I mean, almost more unrealistic, I think, than the Democratic proposal. Because
and that's
of those
what the Democrats would say. And they have been saying that mm-hmm. they feel they get criticized for not coming out with a balanced budget plan or what have you. And they say, well, look at the Republicans and look at the governor's budget. That's not realistic. That's not, I mean, it's technically balanced, but does anybody think the governor wants to eliminate CalWORKs? So you're right. And you're right. It's a different dynamic every year. We've seen the governor work budgets in different ways. I mean, there were times in the past where he was with the Democrats and just had to try to pick off Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
This year he's working in conjunction with the Republicans. They've gotten behind his budget. So, that, you know, he's clearly there's a different dynamic there. And
it makes me wonder, though, when the Republicans were having these comments on Tuesday after the Democratic budget proposal came out, Dennis Hollingsworth, who leads the Republicans in the state Senate, made a comment that I wonder if it's going to become part of the discussion and it'll be said, or it was a moment of honesty that he doesn't want to keep talking about. But he effectively said, we can't afford things like welfare assistance right now. We just can't afford it.
Huh.
And I used it in my radio report the next day because I did think it was a very stark comment that you don't hear. And there's a lot of discussion that if you look at some of the areas of the state of California where the social services are used the most, they are represented more by Republicans than by Democrats. And so it does beg the question, would the Republican rank and file legislators vote for a budget that completely eliminated welfare to work assistance, child care assistance, and on, you know, some of the other things, you know, dramatic cutbacks and all these other things that those communities, by being harder hit economically, not as wealthy and affluent communities, really need. You know, and so it's a fascinating dynamic to have that whether that's actually a discussion point Republicans will say again, you know, we just can't afford welfare to work or not. Hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and there's been talk, well, Democrats say, well, maybe we should put up that governor's budget and see how many people actually vote for it. And I don't know. I mean,
I've always been fascinated why they don't, because wouldn't that really?
It's always been described as like a nuclear option almost.
It is, but wouldn't it really focus the debate? I mean, granted, you and I would love to cover it because it would be a fascinating discussion.
We might not like the late night or early morning that we.
But it would. I mean, I am kind of perplexed. I mean, I don't, you know, I guess Democrats don't do it because in the back of their mind, they think there's some chance it'll pass. I mean, which doesn't make any sense to me. They hold almost every card, not all the cards, mm-hmm. and how many votes you need. But it would put people on record as saying, if you rhetorically say this is a good budget, show us the vote.
Yeah.
Because Democrats do that in what's called, and we get all these discussions that these are political drills to put these budgets up for a vote. You know, this is my little soapbox. It's a nonpartisan soapbox, but it's an observer soapbox that I don't really see them as drills as much because I do find it, you know, people have to stand up and be on record what they support. If it doesn't pass, then at least they've said, I support this, I don't. You know, like Democrats say, well, you see where I'm going.
Yeah. Here.
And so I would love to see people be on record at least.
On record,
With that budget that the governor put out there to kind of see what, you know, what happens when push comes to shove of people who represent communities that could be impacted.
You know, they don't want to be on record. As we've seen, they've wiped votes clean that they've made in the past and controversial votes that they've wiped clean. And I guess that in some ways they feel that either putting it on record would hurt somebody politically or it would just be an embarrassment and it would set back negotiations.
I guess that's probably what it is that they think that it's some kind of public display of something that then people would have hurt feelings that they had to vote yes or no or stay away on, which is the internal reality.
They're not playing tiddlywinks here. I mean, we're right.
But that goes to the internal reality of how this all works is that, you know, I'm sitting here saying the public would like to know probably where people stand.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, they do have to come together and find something.
That's true. I mean, you're right. I mean, it does, these budgets get negotiated out and, you know, it seems like, I mean, you can even see this between, within the same party. I mean, Democrats, when they were, or when Steinberg and Perez were not on the same page, they were at times taking pains to not publicly go out and blast each other in some ways. Although you would hear privately they were complaining about each other, but you know, there's a real concern about going out and embarrassing somebody else and what that would do to negotiations and what that would do to your strategy in terms of negotiations. So,
yeah.
I don't know, greater political minds than my own have probably thought this through, and maybe they've recognized that there's no upside to putting these votes on record. But
before we wrap this podcast up, just quickly, you and I have both written about something I wanted to get you to talk about briefly in the couple of minutes we'll take here before my audio recorder runs out. And that is, that's always a good way to end the podcast. And that is the governor's PR campaign. And the governor's saying the $50 million a day, the deficit clock that he has, you know, all of these things. There's a lot of PR to that. And the governor continues to make that point that we're losing $50 million or that, you know, the deficit, the wording has changed a lot of times.
Sure.
The reality is the governor's using averages.
Sure.
He's making, and you and I both have kind of written something that says, well, yeah, but, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a simple calculation that, you know, you take the deficit and divide by 365, essentially. And you just can't do it. I mean, the real life impacts are not that simple.
But we don't spend that money every day.
We don't
the
spend that money every day.
Money doesn't come in and go every day, and
yeah,
you know. But it's the way he is trying to present the problem to the public.
Sure.
Maybe it makes his larger point, but then there are people like
you and
me.
It's a very simple way for the public to look at it and, you know, digest it. It makes good TV with that deficit clock outside his office. But yeah, and it also presumes, you know, a lot that all the solutions are going to be cuts or revenues that are felt on a daily basis, and that's just not the case. As you mentioned, you talked about every different solution under the sun that is in the budget plan, whether it be these shifts or these internal borrowing or what have you. That, you know, the timing of those things is not, it's not like it's done every day. It's, you know, they happen at different points in the year.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they do, there are ways to mitigate the impacts of that, of the time lost in not having those solutions.
So suffice it to say, at week's end, we might be moving, but we haven't moved enough to call it movement. I don't even know what we'd call it. I don't know what to call it.
I think we've run out of ways to describe.
We're just what here.
We're just here. We're just here waiting and waiting and.
And still waiting.
Yeah.
And we'll wait some more. And I'm sure maybe people will wait along with us and listen to the podcast. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Breaking it down. No, you get to come back some more this summer. You're hired. That's Kevin Yamamura from the Sacramento
Bee. I haven't driven too many people away.
No. We're driving them to the Bee.
Anthony's much funnier than
I am. We're driving them to the Bee to read your stories. Subscribe, folks.
Subscribe.
Sacramento Bee. They'll take all they can get. Or at sacbee.com. You can check it out. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.